Hi there. Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review, the hour where we stop down and make sense of this week's news. So happy this week to have with us Chris Vance, public affairs consultant, former state legislator, former King County Council member, former Washington State Republican Party chair. Good, huh?
Yeah, new member of the ACLU.
We're going to talk about the newly active new ACLU member, Republican Chris Vance. We'll get there. Tina Podlodowski is the brand new, your first week in office, right?
This is my first Friday on the job.
This is your first radio appearance.
Absolutely.
Since becoming the Washington State Democratic Party chair. Thanks for coming.
And of course, I do it with you on KUOW.
Obviously, as traditionally presidents have done for decades.
Of course.
Erica C. Barnett, the C is for crank.com. So good to have you back. Hey, Erica.
Hey, Bill.
Let's talk about the news. It is Washington State versus President Trump again today. As we're doing the show in the noon hour, a Seattle federal judge is about to consider and maybe rule today on a lawsuit that Washington's attorney general has filed against President Trump's new travel ban. Tina Podlodowski's counterpart at the state Republican Party, the chair Susan Hutchinson, says Washington's attorney general is playing politics.
I think he knows that he's got very thin ice he's standing on legally. But he's in a situation right now where he's gaining attention of the far left base. You could call them the Sawant primary group, the folks that will decide who the candidate will be out of the Democrat primary. And so today he announced basically that he was running for governor.
Running for governor. We'll see about that. Is this Washington Democrats playing politics, or will this lawsuit actually thwart Trump's travel ban in any way?
Well, I think we have a very good chance of winning, but let's be clear. My counterpart, Susan Hutchinson, clearly doesn't know what she's talking about. You know, doing a Muslim ban and also a travel ban as well on Syrian refugees is clearly unconstitutional. You know, good for Jay Inslee, greater for Bob Ferguson for filing this first in the nation lawsuit. We'll hear from Judge Robart, I think, today at 2:30 in the afternoon.
But as you know, the Trump administration says it's not a Muslim ban.
You know, Trump administration has been calling it a Muslim ban in a variety of ways. If you listen to Trump and all of his henchmen, including folks like Rudy Giuliani, they've been talking about this as a Muslim ban. It's clearly unconstitutional. So I have a lot of faith in our ability to win this particular lawsuit. I'm also disturbed that you're not hearing, though, from other folks in the GOP, unlike our very heroic Chris Vance across the way here, who are standing against this particular ban.
Chris, why is that? Former head of the state Republican Party, you've come out against many aspects of the Trump presidency. Do you also agree? We'll talk about Republicans more, but on the subject of the travel ban, do you agree that, like it or not, is it constitutional, do you think?
I think this this executive order definitely violates at least the spirit of the Fifth, the First, and the 14th Amendments of the Constitution. I'm not a lawyer. It seems to me that there is a sound basis for this litigation. That's why so many lawsuits have been settled. More than one federal judge so far has stayed the order. The judge, the very first night, said that the plaintiffs had a strong likelihood of succeeding. I don't think this is a slam dunk either way. And the other thing about being, you know, attorneys general don't file lawsuits that are frivolous. That's a good way to get unelected. It'll be interesting.
Susan Hutchinson said it's a good way to get elected governor in this state.
Well, look, she's right about one thing. There's obvious political benefit for Bob Ferguson to do this, but he's not the only one. I mean, I think 15 different attorney generals have launched litigation on this. I think the executive order is wrong. I think it is step one towards a Muslim ban. Absolutely. Will it be overturned in court? I don't know, because I'm not a trained lawyer.
And let's be clear who Bob is standing up for here in Washington State. I mean, there's over 7,200 non-citizen immigrants in Washington State who are impacted by a ban like this. So Bob is standing up for these immigrants in Washington State, and also, I believe, for the American values as well, for something that's so blatantly unconstitutional. So Chris is right. It's not a frivolous lawsuit. I'm hopeful that we'll see something good this afternoon.
Erica C., anything to add?
Well, I think the notion that this is I believe Chair Hutchinson said a Sawant, the Sawant movement of the Democratic Party. First of all, that's a weird dog whistle. Second, it's it's
meaning she's getting at Chamisal wants what, foreign background? What are you whistling at me about whistling?
Possibly the fact that she's an immigrant.
Uh-huh.
More innocuously, just the fact that this is supposedly a left-wing Seattle sentiment, when in fact in the United States, I think that the most recent survey done just 3 days ago said that only a third of people believe that this will make them any safer. 54% are against this ban. And so to say that this is, you know, outside the mainstream to be fighting against a ban that, you know, that everyone associated with it, including Donald Trump on the campaign trail and afterwards, has said is meant to be a move toward a Muslim ban, is out of the mainstream is just wrong. It's a completely reasonable lawsuit. I don't know what the courts will rule in terms of its whether they're standing on thin legal ice or not. But I think that it's clearly unconstitutional in that it not only primarily targets Muslims, but it gives preference explicitly or implicitly to Christians. And Donald Trump said explicitly that it was meant to give preference to Christians.
And let's also talk about the bizarre news conference that Susan Hutchison held regarding this, where she likened being delayed at an airport for 30 minutes to what's happening to Muslim and refugees and Syrian refugees around the country. You're talking about 5-year-olds in handcuffs. You're talking about 88-year-olds in wheelchairs who are now allowed their medication. You're talking about families who spent 20 hours without food or water and facing the ultimate issue of being deported back to a particular country. So I think Susan, as the head of the Republican Party here in Washington State, is clearly out of touch with the sentiment of Washingtonians. And she's also clearly out of touch with what happens in this particular ban and how we need to stand up, not just for this particular ban, but for the rights of all Americans.
And since we're talking about Susan, I think I agree with Tina. She's out of touch with Washington State. Donald Trump did not win Washington State. He got 38% here. But she has become his number one cheerleader, no matter what he does. In contrast,
well, you've been a party chair. Is she supposed to express her personal opinion or reflect back whatever she thinks is the mood in Washington State?
That is a hard thing. There were times when I was chairman when Republicans were fighting among themselves. And then I would try and have rhetoric that said, well, some Republicans think this and some Republicans think that. For instance, when President Bush had the bill to expand prescription drug coverage under Medicare, a lot of Republicans were very much against that. Right now, there are a lot of Republicans who are speaking out against this executive order. Condoleezza Rice, Lindsey Graham, John McCain, Ben Sasse, a number of Republicans are saying that what Trump did was wrong. Susan Hutchison should reflect that. Instead, it's just whatever. Ever since Donald Trump became our nominee, she's been there with pom-poms cheering him on. And it just rankles because there are still so many Republicans who don't support him. And it's so out of step with the voters of Washington State.
Erica, what did you think of Sound Transit closing the SeaTac airport stop during the protest at the airport?
Well, real quickly, can I just add one thing on Susan Hutchison?
Uh-huh.
During the campaign, she was the chief apologist in Washington State for Donald Trump's comments about groping women, mm-hmm. saying that he made them when he was a Democrat, as if that mattered.
Dear Susan Hutchison, would you like to come on KUOW? Because we've just piled on.
I think that's a great idea.
I've interviewed her before, and so please come back to KOW. We'll try to hook that up.
Yeah, I'd love to talk with her.
Okay.
I found that behavior very curious as well, when there was so much dissent within the party. But to the question of the Sound Transit trains, the Port of Seattle police apparently asked Sound Transit to not open the doors during the protest.
Saturday evening,
and they cited public safety concerns.
Didn't they think too many protesters were getting in ahead of the security? Was that the idea?
What they said was that they anticipated a problem later if there weren't enough security on hand, and so they wanted to give security a period of time to get there. Now, whether or not that's true, I don't think there was a threat at the time, and I think it was a clear decision that violated the protesters' right to go to the airport, which is a place they are allowed to be and protest. The example that sprung to mind is, imagine if the port had shut down the freeways so that people couldn't get to the airport. Shutting down light rail is no different. Trains were crowded with people trying to get to the airport, and they were turned away. And Sound Transit has since said that they're going to change their policies so that they have to be consulted before the port makes that kind of decision, and that they will discuss whether it's a reasonable thing to do.
Chris, you disagree?
Well, I wasn't there.
Yeah.
That's important. I mean, law enforcement made a decision on the ground. None of us were there. None of us saw what was happening. I don't know.
Defer to law enforcement in that
on
situation?
On this one. I mean, I would be opposed to this. If I were still on the county council, I'd be asking questions. Was this done to try and limit the size of the protest in any way to squelch people's First Amendment rights? Or was it just a physical public safety concern? That's two different things. Somebody should be looking into this, but I don't think we should jump to the conclusion that the Port of Seattle wanted to limit the protest. I doubt that the port is any fan of Donald Trump.
I'm not imputing any motivation to them. I'm saying that the effect was that people weren't able to protest. And in fact, I mean, you want to talk about public safety. People were walking from the Tukwila International Boulevard station to the airport, and from Point South to the airport, so that they could get to the protest. So I don't see how that's particularly safe. But in addition, I mean, I think you have to be able to demonstrate that there's an actual public safety problem rather than just saying we're going to shut down public transit. I mean, that is a rather extreme action to say we're not going to stop at the airport.
But Tina, Chris saying in the moment, law enforcement does, you know, that's a time when they make calls like that.
You know, and as a former Seattle City Council member who was the public safety chair, I think sometimes in the moment decisions get made and they're not necessarily run up the chain to make sure that you're taking care of public safety as well as freedom of assembly and freedom of speech rights. My understanding is that this was resolved fairly quickly, and Dow Constantine, county executive, and the management at Sound Transit were able to realize what was happening, make sure that there was something thoughtful that was going on here, and then work on procedures for the next time. Because I do feel that folks were overwhelmed. But let's be clear, there were, you know, Port Commissioner Courtney Gregoire was there fighting on this particular issue, as well as two U.S. congresspeople, Pramila Jayapal and Susan DelBene. So there was an opportunity here to actually talk to an actual port commissioner about this, who was on the scene to see what was happening before this call was made. But I do get that sometimes you get overwhelmed in the moment, but let's make sure that there's a process in place going forward.
What do you think of these huge local companies supporting the state's challenge against the president's travel ban? Amazon, Microsoft, Expedia are saying it hurts our workers, hurts our business. Chris, how much do you think that objection matters?
I think it matters a lot if they keep doing it and they get politically active, and if the business community will oppose the reelection of members of Congress who continue to not oppose Donald Trump.
Which businesses and which members are you thinking of?
Microsoft, everyone else who's worried about immigration and trade. Immigration, especially H-1B visas and the ability to have skilled workers, and trade, those are maybe the two biggest issues for the Seattle business community. They need to speak up and make it clear to the four members of Congress who are Republicans from Washington State that they disagree with Donald Trump. I mean, I am horrified that Donald Trump reversed 60 years of trade policy, worldwide trade policy, going back to the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs back in 1947, to lower trade barriers, to grow the world's economy, and just killed the TPP. And no one said a word. Where's Boeing? Where's Microsoft? They should be livid about that, and they should be livid about this immigration ban. The business community can have a big impact here if they will decide to get militant. I want to see them start protesting.
Is Dave Reichert nervous right now?
I think that's exactly right.
Congressman of Reichert, Auburn.
A great friend of mine. He is the chairman of the Trade Subcommittee on the Ways and Means Committee, a member of the TPP caucus. He's worked on TPP forever. Donald Trump just killed TPP, and Dave didn't say a word. And so, I mean, the business community has got to get really active and aggressive about this. That'll get Republicans' attention.
Well, as the Democratic Party chair, I should say Dave Reichert should be nervous. Kathy McMorris Rogers should be nervous. In fact, any Republican in the state of Washington should be nervous if they are not speaking up on these issues. And we haven't heard that from the Republican congresspeople in Washington state. We certainly haven't heard it from a variety of Republicans in the state house as well. Everybody from Mark Schessler to, you know, I've got two jobs and I'm not going to serve anybody, Doug Erickson. I mean, all of that is happening here in this particular state. And people's eyes are being opened up to what's happening with Trump and Trump's Teflon in terms of what he says. But what are the consequences that are going to happen in election time? I'm looking forward to the special elections in 2017. And boy, am I looking forward to the midterms in 2018.
getting back to the question of these companies, I wonder a little bit how much Donald Trump respects tech companies and respects companies like Starbucks to begin with. On the campaign trail, he made it pretty clear that he thinks of American companies as being, you know, steel companies, coal companies, car manufacturers, sort of the old 20th century idea of what industry is and what the titans of industry look like. Tech companies tend to be, and their CEOs, like Howard Schultz, tend to be a little more liberal. And I wonder to what extent he's just going to think these are coastal elites. Let's all boycott Starbucks and let's make fun of them.
Which is a thing, by the way. Howard Schultz came out and said that Starbucks is going to hire 10,000 refugees. And there was a backlash, you know, hey, why don't you hire veterans? Where probably us coastal elites know that Starbucks has a program to hire 10,000 veterans and they're most of the way there.
Well,
but
and I, you know, I'm from a part of the country that is not coastal elite.
You're from Texas.
I'm from Texas. And before that, I'm from Mississippi. Try finding a Starbucks in Meridian, Mississippi. So I wonder the Starbucks boycott, how meaningful it really is anyway, because Starbucks, by the way, tend to concentrate in cities, which voted against Donald Trump and for Hillary Clinton. But I just wonder. I mean, Donald Trump does not think on a very deep level, in my opinion, and so I don't think that's saying anything terribly controversial. But I just wonder to what extent he's going to say, you know, oh my God, you know, Microsoft up in Seattle doesn't like me, and Starbucks up in Seattle doesn't like me.
I don't think he cares. I don't think he cares at all what Microsoft or Boeing think of him. But Jamie Hura Butler, Kathy McMorris Rogers, Dave Reichert, and Dan Newhouse, they do.
Four Congress members.
From Washington State. Mm-hmm. They do. Yeah. And Donald Trump can't do everything by executive order. He needs Congress. And it is the people in the Republican business community need to make it clear to Republican House members and senators, we don't support Trump's policies on immigration and trade. If they don't, then they're going to shame on them, because this stuff's going to keep happening.
Well, let's pause that there. Again, a Seattle federal judge today considering Washington State's challenge to the president's executive order on immigration. Our state's attorney general wants a restraining order on enforcing that ban. So we'll see how that works out. This year's Starbucks Christmas cups will just have the word refugees on it. I've heard that. I read that on Breitbart. It's just going to say Merry Refugees. So we'll see how it goes.
And then
over.
We're all also waiting for what's next from Trump, right? I'm a lesbian mom of three. We're waiting for the executive orders on the LGBTQ community. We've heard those are coming and those rumblings. You know, we've talking about a man who's taking the references to Jews out of a Holocaust Remembrance Day proclamation and talking about Holocaust Remembrance Day in that speech. He's got political staff that are reviewing the science that's coming out of the EPA before it gets out to us. So, and really putting the kibosh on that. He's challenging sovereignty of Native American tribes. So all of that is interesting in this context of how is the business community in Washington State and the political community in Washington State going to react to that? So it's not just this effort. There's more down the pike.
I know how one man, one Republican is reacting to all of that. He is taking to the streets for the first time in your life, right? We'll talk about that. Kent, will you tell us the story?
I will tell you the story.
All right. ACLU member Chris Vance and Erica C. Barnett and Tina Podlodowski. Stay tuned for the Week in Review. Tweet while you listen. We are at KUOW, and this is the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Erica C. Barnett and Tina Podlodowski and Chris Vance. Still a Republican? I ask you this every time I see you.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I'm not going to let Donald Trump drive me out of my party ever.
But you did.
Come on, Chris. Come on over.
Come over to the Tina Podlodowski side.
Exactly.
Tina, I'll give you a list of things you guys are wrong about.
Okay. But for once, for the first time in your life, you said you became a protester and you became a member of the ACLU. You chafe at protesters.
No, well,
generally you've said that.
No,
the protest gets under your skin. No?
Not really.
Okay.
So I was sitting there Saturday morning.
Chafe or you don't chafe?
Sitting there Saturday morning with my wife around the kitchen table, literally, you know, like good American, and I'm reading a summary of Donald Trump's executive order. And now understand that you got to remember now, back in the fall of 2015. A lot of Republicans, including me, said that we needed to put a pause on the number of refugees coming into this country from ISIS-held areas specifically, because it turned out that one of the attackers in the Paris attacks was masquerading, hiding as a refugee. There were reports that ISIS was embedding terrorists into the flow of refugees going into Europe. And a lot of people, including the FBI, said, we can't vet these refugees coming from the parts of Syria. So a very specific thing. And Republicans got blasted for that, being racist.
Why can't they vet those refugees?
I don't know. But the Jim Comey testified in front of Congress that
their homes and their documents and their hometowns barely exist.
Yes. So I thought perhaps that Trump had come up with a reasonable proposal to better safeguard us against possible terrorists. But you read the order and it does three things. First, it bans everyone who's not a Christian from these seven countries. Well, that's bad. It goes a long way. I don't like that. Then the second step is it directs the bureaucracy to expand that list, which they're working on right now, to more countries. Okay. And then the third part, which is the worst part, directs the national security agencies to come up with a new process, what Trump calls extreme vetting, to decide who will and will not enter the United States, both refugees and immigrants. And it's based upon their ideology and values. And there's language in there saying that if there anybody believes in a violent ideology, what they place above the United States Constitution, we're not going to admit them to the U.S. And that just set off alarm bells for me, because I have heard hundreds, I mean so many, so-called conservatives voice the opinion that Islam itself is a violent ideology, and that every Muslim is taught they must place Sharia law, whatever that is, above their loyalty to anything else. And basically that we shouldn't be allowing any Muslims in the United States. And I've even heard people say we should deport the Muslims who are here. And it seems to me it's pretty clear. The third step of Donald Trump's order, they're going to come up with some sort of process that's going to make it darn near impossible for any Muslims to enter the United States. And you combine that with the draft executive orders we've seen regarding legal immigration, where they're talking about clamping down on people coming here legally, even deporting immigrants who are here, like on public assistance. It's crystal clear to me that Donald Trump wants to turn my party, the party of Abraham Lincoln, into the modern-day anti-immigrant know-nothings. And I was like, I just got angry and went online, joined the ACLU. My wife said, you know, there's a protest tonight in Seattle. I'm like, we're going. And we did. And
what was that like for you?
I didn't have a sign, so I felt left out. Oh. But it was
Tini, can you hook him up with a sign?
I can hook Chris up with a sign anytime he wants. And again, that Democratic Party card is waiting on my desk for you, Chris.
Will you teach him some chants? Because how's he supposed to know what rhymes with hey, hey, ho, ho? Okay? This is new for
you know, it was the most interesting thing. And Anne commented on this. There were so many people there who held signs saying this is the first time I've ever been to a protest. Hmm. It didn't look like it looked like a lot of average Americans were coming together, not your typical professional protester crowd that you might imagine.
I mean, like Erica C. Barnett
and
that type.
It was inspiring. There's so many people there so moved by this.
I have to say, Chris, the notion that that like most protesters are, you know, paid professional
I didn't
protesters
say that.
or the professional protester, we'll just go with that.
I thought you meant small p, the people who are out there often, early and often.
Yes.
Well, I mean, it is really inspiring to see more people coming in, and I'm really glad that you're on board with this, Chris. I also hope that you will be on board and vocal, and more Republicans like you will be on board and vocal when we continue hearing things like Donald Trump saying, I believe yesterday, that there's a rumor that the counterterrorism task force is going to be focused exclusively on terrorism resulting from quote unquote radical Islam. We have had an actual terrorism problem in this country from primarily white supremacists for a very long time. And now the policy of the federal government is going to be to explicitly ignore that type of terrorism, which is much more prevalent in this country. I want to hear Republicans speaking up when Trump is out there decrying an attack at the Louvre that didn't kill anybody, while ignoring an attack at a mosque in Canada that did kill people. I want to see you more than just protesting in the streets about one particularly, absurd and insulting and radical proposal to ban Muslims from certain countries. And
you want Chris to be a professional protester?
I do. I mean, I chafe at that term. I'm not a protester myself. As a journalist, I cover protests, but at the same time, I know people who do go to protests somewhat more regularly than most, and it's because they actually have been engaged in these issues for a longer time than some of the people who are coming on board now, and that's because they're very important issues.
Tina, does a protest feel important, or is it actually important?
I think it's both.
In Washington State.
In Washington State.
In blue bubble Seattle.
Well, you know what? It's not just blue bubble of Seattle. I mean, look what happened the day after Trump's inauguration. You had millions of people marching around the globe.
Right.
You had the hundreds of thousands of people marching around the state of Washington. When you get 2,000 people in Ellensburg, when you get 1,000 people in Ephrata,
right,
when you get people in Walla Walla, when you get Spokane, when you get Colville, when you get all of these places around the state where people are marching, people have taken the first step to create really a populist movement here that is different from Trump's populist movement.
Is that protest effective in Seattle?
Well, you know, I think it's effective in terms of people taking the first step to move from being marchers to creating a movement to turning this into political action. And very quickly, we're seeing people politicized as a result of this. We're inundated in the Democratic Party for people knowing what they can do, what elections they can work on, what policy pieces that they can work on. And it's very personal in some ways for folks. It's, you know, for me, I'm a child of immigrants. Both my parents were refugees from World War II, from Poland. It took my parents almost 5 years to get here in terms of immigration quotas and all those things that were happening under President Truman to make that happen. I understand this whole vetting process. So when you think about what's happening with folks that we're trying to get over here who are refugees, folks who helped our soldiers in Iraq, for example, people who are really under death orders, you know, this is, and they're being vetted for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. This is not a system that people find sustainable. But again, it moves to all of these other issues as well, and certainly a political movement against what Donald Trump and his cronies are selling.
Okay, so Chris, you said you feel some sympathy about the problem, the difficulty of vetting people that, for example, ISIS might be embedding to come here. So what are you saying is the proper Republican policy about better safe than sorry and people coming into this country?
Well, again, just rewinding back to when this whole controversy began, it became after the Paris attacks and Congress held hearings. And the director of the FBI testified saying we cannot adequately vet these people. The EU talked about how they were very concerned that ISIS was using this horrible refugee crisis to their advantage, and they were embedding people within the flow of refugees. That was 2 years ago now. I don't know where the situation stands now. I don't know if the FBI would still say they can't adequately vet people. The point is, though, I think there was a legitimate concern about a limited type of pause to figure out what's going on about ISIS, for instance, stole the machinery to make passports in Syria so they can make fake passports. That's legitimate, I think. But just, I think this goes way beyond that. If you read the things that Steve Bannon has written and Donald Trump talks about, they believe that there is a worldwide struggle going on between Christendom and the Muslim world. And I think it's entirely credible to believe that their end result is they want to really dramatically limit or eliminate any Muslims coming to this country.
And
let me just say one more thing there, because I've got to really walk a line here, because I don't agree with the Democrats. I think one of the worst mistakes the Democrats make is not saying the words radical Islamic terrorism, because it's real. The Muslim world is at war with itself. You have Sunni versus Shia. You have secular versus jihadist. There are ISIS wants to kill everybody who isn't a radicalized Sunni Muslim. They're harder almost on the Shia Muslims than each other. So to try and deny that Muslim terrorism is a problem is a huge mistake. But I just think Donald Trump wants to go much farther and stop all Muslims coming here.
But I think the big question is the legitimacy issue here of the arguments that are being put forth. Mm-hmm. And I think that the concern has been that the actual legitimacy of the arguments are shrinking to the point where all we're getting are the lies and the posturing. I mean, look at this morning in Kellyanne Conway's statement about the Bowling Green massacre that was done by two Iraqis here in the United States.
She said she made a mistake.
Well, how could you make a mistake? Wait,
when
come
she
on.
Got
it's
caught.
A massacre. When she got caught. Right.
Okay.
The only Bowling Green massacre you'd ever have is if Western Kentucky University actually happened to beat Louisiana Tech in college basketball. That's the only time that would be there.
Can we talk about a different kind of political, I guess, protest? The city of Seattle, on a different subject, it apparently is going to divest from Wells Fargo because that bank is a big funder of the Dakota Access Pipeline, and President Trump's trying to go ahead with that pipeline project. But Chris, that you called left-wing political theater.
That's why I'm not a Democrat, okay? So it's things like that. it's silly political theater. You know, we want to make a...
Why is that silly?
Because I remember, you know, I'm old enough to remember when we were debating divesting from anybody who did business with South Africa. And there were a Democratic state senator from the city of Seattle named Ray Moore, who had worked in investing and banking his whole life, said, you can't do that. I have a fiduciary duty to the bondholders and the people who are depending on these pensions. And if you want me to divest from every Fortune 500 company that does business in South Africa, it'll destroy this fund. The city of Seattle needs to make decisions based upon sound economics, not because they disagree with some sort of political statement. It's the kind of silliness we saw from the Seattle City Council when they want to tear down the dams in eastern Washington. It's why the rest of the state gets so grumpy with the city of Seattle.
Well, Erica looks puzzled.
Well, I am puzzled because the city of Seattle they're going to move their money to a different bank. It doesn't harm the city of Seattle financially to do this. And they're not trying to force Eastern Washington to do anything. They're making a statement on something that's happening elsewhere. Yes, but this is their call. Whether it's going to have any impact with Wells Fargo, which has trillions of dollars in accounts with cities all across the country, is another question. But I think, you know, this kind of statement, and in addition, I mean, this is not the only reason that the city of Seattle has a problem with Wells Fargo. They started talking about and indeed pulled some accounts from Wells Fargo last year over the issue not of the Dakota Pipeline, but of the fact that Wells Fargo opened $100 million in fraudulent accounts. So
when I first heard about this, I thought that the pulling the money from Wells Fargo was about that scandal.
Right. And so they've had issues with Wells Fargo for a long time. So this is not surprising. And whether you think that, you know, the fraud problem, which impacted millions of Americans, you know, is also a thing to the subject of silly political theater is one thing. But, you know, I do think that by making statements like this, the city is doing a little more than just, waving their fingers at Eastern Washington dams or circus animals cite another one that people.
Yeah. Eric, I wanted to ask you, Erica, council member Mike O'Brien said Washington needs a state owned bank. Do we?
Well, I mean, this is one of those proposals. It's in the legislature now. It's being proposed by Bob Hasegawa. And Tina, maybe you have a longer memory than I do on this, but I know this is something that has come up periodically.
Absolutely.
Over the years. So Mike O'Brien is saying, well, let's just do a state-owned bank. I think that's a little unrealistic, maybe more than a little unrealistic in a year.
That would be a bank that would hold accounts for marijuana growers, no problem.
Yeah. I mean, that has also come up in that area. But, I mean, this is a year when the state is dealing with potentially the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. What are we going to do about all the people here who are going to lose their health care? It's still dealing with McCleary. And we still have a Republican majority effectively in the Senate. So, you know, I don't think that's going anywhere. I could be wrong. I could come back on in 2 months and find out that, you know, that everybody decided this is a great idea. But I think it's just it's a rhetorical flourish on Mike O'Brien's part.
So the word that has been mentioned here, though, is values. Right. And all cities, I don't care if it's Seattle, if it's Omaha, if it's Chicago, if it's Miami, they are making business choices for that city based upon values. And socially responsible investing is one of those things. I was a city city council member in the 1990s, we've passed a number of ordinances or done the work around different values that make sense for our citizens. For example, in 1996, I passed an ordinance that required companies that were doing more than $25,000 a year in contracting with the city of Seattle had to provide domestic partner benefits. That was a values-based statement around a business objective. So when you look at this with Wells Fargo and other cities that are making similar kinds of decisions, it's not political theater. It's values-based for the city itself and its population. And for me, it's also standing in solidarity with all of the issues that came up around fraud at Wells Fargo, but also standing in solidarity with our sovereign tribes as well around the particular pipeline. You know, we've got 29 sovereign tribes in Washington State, as well as urban Indians. Those sovereign tribes are under attack from the Trump administration. This issue of something so fundamental as water rights stands, start taking happen. And frankly, political movements for the last decade have really started to take these stands from municipalities. So kudos to the city of Seattle. Kudos to other cities who have values.
Chris, are you remembering why you were a Republican?
Oh, very much so. And, and again, you know, this is one of the things when you serve at one level of government, you need to stay in your lane. You know, when I was on the King County Council, some people would always want to get involved in more global issues and try and bring them back and say, no, our job is to govern King County and run this government, not try and impose our values on other people.
Okay. Chris Vance, former State Republican Party chair. Tina Podlatowski, the current Washington State Democratic Party chair. Erica C. Barnett watches them. She's a journalist. She knows her stuff and writes at thecisforcrank.com. And we're going to come back and talk about what free speech on campus means in 2017 and more. Stay tuned. Now on KUOW's Week in Review, let's talk about free speech and when it's time to cancel speech. This week, UC Berkeley canceled a planned speech by the divisive, insulting, white nationalist writer named Milo Yiannopoulos. The university called off the speech after protesters against the speaker were getting violent, starting fires, breaking windows, throwing smoke bombs. Milo Yiannopoulos says UC Berkeley canceling his speech just shows you what liberals are about these days.
It turns out that the progressive left, the social justice left, the feminist Black Lives Matter, Antifa left, the hard left, which has become so utterly antithetical to free speech in the last few years, is taking a turn post-Trump's election where they simply will not allow any speaker on campus, even somebody as silly and harmless and gay as me, to have their voice heard. They won't allow students to listen to differing points of view. They're absolutely petrified by alternative visions of how the world ought to look. And people with arguments and fact and reason that don't conform to the crazy social justice left vision of the universe.
There's a national debate now over whether UC Berkeley did the right thing, and the debate involves the University of Washington because last month the UW College Republicans hosted that same speaker. Some progressives didn't want him on campus, but the UW president said this is his free speech. Protests got ugly. A man was shot outside the event. Erica C. Barnett, you were at the speech. First of all, would you remind those listeners who don't know basically what happened outside the protest?
So outside, there were people gathered in Red Square at the UW, and they essentially, after the people who were going to go in initially as VIPs and as press, so including myself, got inside, the protesters formed a wall that prevented people from proceeding. And it was, what I saw was pretty orderly and frankly a little boring. I mean, there were, you know, as Milo said in that clip, there were anti-fascist organizers there sort of alongside or, you know, mixed in the crowd with people who were there in support of Milo speaking. And while inside, while Milo was talking inside, only about half full Kane Hall crowd listening to him, reports came down that somebody had been shot. The person who was shot turned out to be a medic for the protesters who were there to protest his appearance, but he immediately jumped on it and said that this was yet another example of how the liberals are the real violent criminals who come and try to shut down free speech with violent actions. So, I mean, he's just an absolute...
Well, he also, you were there, but I saw some of the footage. He went to some GoPro footage from his cameraman outside the event that appeared to have, I don't know if they were anti-fascist demonstrators, but anti-Milo demonstrators. They were look like they were jostling him, grabbed or knocked his camera or something, right? I mean,
it was hard to tell from that footage because it was a GoPro camera.
Yes.
There were definitely some scuffles. I mean, I got shoved around a little bit outside in the crowd. I would say that's par for the course for virtually any crowd, especially where you have hundreds of police officers. I think that the presence of all those cops does tend to escalate protests and it tends to escalate the intensity of the crowd and the scene. There were definitely some little scuffles outside, but nothing along the lines of, you know, mass violence. And again, the guy who was shot was a protester, not somebody who was there to, you know, encourage, quote unquote, free speech.
Well, is there anything to, I want to hear from our rest of our panel, but Erica, you were there and you've written about this and considered it. Do you think there's anything to Milo Yiannopoulos's claim that the modern left wing, they're whipped up, they're upset about Donald Trump, but whether they meant to or not, there is a strain, any significant strain that is, I think his words were, antithetical to free speech. Do you think that's just totally bogus or there's something to his claim?
I think that's bogus. I think that what people were saying about his speech specifically here and what people are saying at campuses where he's speaking is that free speech, and I really wish that this would be a lesson in what censorship means for people on college campuses who maybe aren't as familiar with the law around this and the history of it. Censorship does not mean that unless you provide a forum for every single type of speech, however heinous, you are censoring. I don't have to take my blog and hand it over to, to Milo or to Tina or to Chris.
But doesn't the public University of Washington have a bigger responsibility to air divergent views than you do on your blog?
Certainly they have a responsibility to air divergent views. I would argue that Milo doesn't have views. He has provocation. Mm-hmm. What he said inside was, you pulled a clip that was airable on the radio. Most of what he said was not. And I think that, and it's not just that it's, you know, it's cursing, it's that, you know, most of his slides were, you know, calling women who protest femme squatches and dykes and lots of, you know, just really saying that they want to rape themselves. It was incredibly offensive and also kind of content free.
Okay.
And so, no, I don't think the university has any obligation under the Constitution, under the law, under just ordinary decency to say, you know, we're going to spend public dollars opening up this campus to this man and his security, paying for security for University of Washington security. And also, I mean, we're paying the taxpayers of the city of Seattle for the hundreds of police officers who were there because Milo was there and for no other reason.
Chris, does that sound right?
No, I mean, the University of Washington did the right thing by letting him speak. They had, because it's not about him. It's about college Republicans. They are a legitimate group on campus. They invited the speaker. They should have a right to bring a speaker in. So the University of Washington did the right thing. Now, with that being said, I wish this clown actually had something interesting to say. He doesn't. He is nothing but a provocateur. And it's all about culture and identity. Look, I've been a Republican for over 35 years, and you have to understand one critical thing. Conservatives view themselves, and always have, as a besieged, put-upon minority, tormented by all the powerful forces in society, Hollywood, big media, big business now, labor unions, and everybody's out to get conservatives and shut them up and doesn't want to hear. And there is something to this. I mean, if you go back, I mean, people treated Ronald Reagan like he was, you know, a pariah of all time. And I think one of the reasons why we have Donald Trump is because the left has called every Republican an extremist and a fascist and a Nazi. And so now people don't even listen anymore. But now the Trump movement and the Bannon movement and the Breitbart crowd and this Milo guy, they've taken it to a massive extreme where their whole message is they're all out to get us. And they rarely talk about policy. It's all tribal. And I want to remind him, the Republican Party is not a protest movement. It's one of America's two great centrist governing parties. But they see everything as it's all a culture war to them. And it's really unfortunate because, you know, you can't fix the culture with legislation. If you're mad about the culture, that's, you know, whatever. But that's one reason why, you know, Trump was so content-free, because he's running on resentment and anger. And I almost think this Milo University tour is meant to stir people up because they feed off of it. The far right feeds off of this. When the far left acts predictably like they do, the far right loves it. And it's really unfortunate.
So, Tina, would prohibiting a speaker like Milo Yiannopoulos be playing into the hands of the far right? So they can point and say, see?
Well, let's talk about who Milo is first. But let me go back to, I would question the judgment of college Republicans to bring someone like Milo in
me
to speak.
Too.
You know, this doesn't make any sense to me. It's, you know, free speech is obviously core value, law of the land, but you still can't yell fire in a crowded theater. If you look at Milo's background, Milo is, you know, an alt-right Breitbart creation. He's not a journalist.
But is he inciting the way you say,
yes,
it's like yelling fire in
absolutely
a theater?
He is yelling fire in a theater, and he's done it previously. The
what
whole
can
Gamergate,
you, what will you point to that he says that yelling fire is
inciting? Sure, the whole Gamergate controversy that Milo was behind in terms of the extreme cyberbullying of women in the gaming industry, the online gaming industry, which is how Milo got his start. He wrote an article that was entitled Feminist Bullies Are Tearing the Video Game Industry Apart. And he essentially,
how is that incitement beyond being obnoxious?
The inciting of violence in terms of what you should and can do to women has given rise to this Milo group that
women. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt.
Yes.
I just wanted to say, in terms of incitement, women actually were threatened. They had to leave their homes. They were doxxed. They were driven off the internet. So
the fire, the yelling fire in a crowded theater is such a pointed example, right? It's an extreme, imminent danger speech thing. But is blaming Milo's dismissive, hateful, et cetera, belittling, dehumanizing. But why does that rise to the level of incitement speech that deserves to be?
He started a campaign of harassment against a trans student at one of the schools where he spoke. That is an actual incitement on that campus of people to harass the student.
Harass how? You mean like cyberbullying?
Cyberbullying, physical bullying, actual violence, destroying.
He incited violence
reputation
against somebody.
Yeah, destroying someone's reputation. And this is something that Milo has done again and again and again. Again, he calls himself, you know, the reincarnation of Satan combined with Oscar Wilde. So you heard he was slightly charming in that particular script in terms of how he identifies himself. I think he's sad. I think he's pathetic. I think he's dangerous. And he's not representative, if I could stand up for my Republican colleagues here for a moment, of what I want to hear from Republican voices as we have policy debates. Milo's not about policy. Milo is about Milo, and Milo is about inciting the kind of violence that drives us apart, as opposed to having a policy discussion where we can actually bring things together. And then, I consistently question the college Republicans inviting him to speak on a public university campus.
Can we stop giving Milo airtime now?
Just one really quick. Can I give myself a little airtime? Just one really quick plug. If people want to see the slides he was using at his presentation, go to my blog, thecsforcrank.com. I have a bunch of pictures of things that are probably less printable than what I described.
Erica C. Barnett and Chris Vance and Tina Podlodowski taking the Week in Review home right after this. KUOW's Week in Review. Yes, Chris?
No,
this is a good sign when people can't wait to keep on talking as soon as we just pause. That's good.
You want me to keep going?
Well, what were you saying?
I was just saying there's so many people today who call themselves conservatives, not because they believe in free market policies or defense policies or anything, but just out of a reaction because they just don't like the left.
Mm-hmm.
And Milo, culturally, urban, the whole urban milieu, the whole culture they see in big cities like Seattle, especially here in the state of Washington. And Milo is a perfect personification of that. He's catnip to those people.
But he's not. This is what makes me crazy about him is he's sort of this, you know, I said that he engages in gay minstrelry. Like he sits up there. He's very, very much a caricature of what I imagine college Republicans think of as a gay man. He wears this giant, you know, mohair outfit, you know, makes all kinds of, he's very flamboyant.
And we're still talking about it.
And we're still talking about it because he is interesting.
This is what makes me crazy about Republicans not standing up against this in their own party and in the conservative movement. And come on, GOP, come on, let's hear it from you. I'm waiting.
You're being invited, GOP. You know who's been outspoken? Sometimes you hear athletes these days being more out about their political views. And on the Seahawks, we heard from Doug Baldwin and Richard Sherman and Michael Bennett. The quarterback of the Seahawks has been the cipher in all of this. Relatively speaking, Russell Wilson has been neutral, playing it down the middle, sponsor friendly. This week in a video posted to Facebook Live, Russell Wilson's getting his hair cut and he's talking to the camera and he says that Trump's negativity's gone too far and Christians like him should love everybody. And he sort of tentatively predicts Trump's downfall.
I don't even know if he's going to be able to last 4 years, in my opinion. You don't want to wish bad upon anybody, because if he doesn't last 4 years, that means that something went wrong. So hopefully nothing goes wrong any more than what it's already doing. But it's just been a crazy 10 days already. And, Barack! Come back, Barack.
That would be nice.
For Russell Wilson, that's explosive. Mm-hmm. He's really bringing it there. Come back, Barack, and Trump won't last 4 years. Which brings me to the question, the Super Bowl is this Sunday. Does Seattle care anymore? Because this is the least I can ever remember hearing about the Super Bowl. Tina, is it just me?
No, I don't think it's just you. I think that we are thinking about other things. Let's just put it in that context. It
seems because the Seahawks are no longer
Seahawks
competitive,
there, right?
I assume you mean that.
No, that the Seahawks are not there. Not that they're
not
competitive.
They won their division.
Exactly. We love our Seahawks.
And that's good enough for you?
They were two games away from the Super Bowl. They're one of the best teams in the NFL. They're going to be one of the best teams in the NFL for a long time. But nobody wins it every year. Even the Patriots don't win it every year.
I think the only person who cares about the Super Bowl right now is Donald Trump. He's made statements that what he's doing politically is going to get more viewers than the Super Bowl ever. So he's, you know, that short-fingered dude in the White House is making comparisons accordingly, and he's the one who's seemingly caring the most.
Eric, I know you've never cared. You didn't care before, and you don't care now.
Is it in Houston? It's in Houston, right?
I have
no idea. Yes, it's in Houston.
Well, that's my hometown, so I'm sure I'll hear something about it after the fact, but probably not until a few weeks afterwards, because the Texans aren't in it.
And George Bush the first is going to, and Barbara are going to do the coin toss, and just for a moment.
They were just in the hospital.
Right.
Really?
Out, and so that's what a great thing that is. And just for a moment, we're going to have a view of what the Republican Party was, and hopefully someday will be again.
Wow. Here's your test, Chris. You're protesting in the streets. You're a member of the ACLU now. Are you going to watch the Super Bowl?
I'm an American.
Yeah.
And I'm a football. I'm a sports fanatic.
Still a Republican.
I am a sports fanatic. Anything involving a ball, I'm in. Okay. And the Super Bowl is, of course, you're going to watch the Super Bowl, for God's sake.
And I'm excited about Chris Vance's donation to the ACLU, his protesting, and I am waiting with bated breath when I can welcome him into the Democratic Party.
And I'm excited about Lady Gaga.
Yeah. Once you Democrats stop trying to raise taxes every legislative session and stop trying to take away our gun rights, then I'll become a Democrat.
He's a Republican. A Republican because he was born that way. Mm. Chris Vance, State Republican Party Chair. Tina Podlodowski, former Republican Party Chair. Tina Podlodowski chairs the State Democratic Party now. Welcome to the job.
Thank you.
Erica C. Barnett, the C is for crank.com. Thanks, Erica.
Thanks.
Chris Vance, keep the faith, whatever your faith is.
My faith is Ronald Reagan conservatism.
All right. We'll keep
Catholicism.
And Catholicism.
There you go.
There'll be a Hail Mary pass in the Super Bowl, very, very possibly. So we'll see how that goes for your favorite team. Thanks for listening. Mm-hmm.